My guest this week is Philip Bubaya, reader in history and a Russian specialist who is based at the University of Kent, where he has been since 1995. We discuss changes that he has witnessed over the years, growing up in Oxford to a sport-loving family. We learn about his parents, who worked for a Christian charity. Philip talks about how faith has changed the way he looks at the world. And we move on to talk about how we tend to find later in life the same characteristics in ourselves that we recognised in our earlier selves. Philip talks about the popular music he heard when he was growing up and how he felt ambivalent about it and how he came to prefer more folk-based music. We learn about how he studied modern languages at Cambridge and how he hadn't planned to go into academia. And Philip reveals how the academic door opened for him. We learn about the trips that Philip made to Russia just before Gorbachev came to power and why it was both scary and frightening at the same time, and how the country had changed by the time he next visited. We find out who the teachers were that inspired him and how he had a good, healthy peer group. We talk about the motivations that we have for the things that we do and the relationship in our professional lives between confidence, or the lack of, and expertise. We discuss the importance of applying one's subject to the life situation of our students and equipping students for their lives ahead. We discuss our respective experiences of voting for the first time in a general election, and we talk about Mikhail Gorbachev and his agenda. The conversation then turns to the question of why, what does it mean to be good, is the elephant in the room. And Philip gives a qualified answer to the question as to whether his memories are mainly positive. He makes a distinction between being peaceful and being positive. We learn why he feels the need to retell and revise his stories, why he thinks we have an innate need to turn a negative memory or experience into a lesson. And then in the final part of the interview, we discuss how the way one remembers can depend on one's mood. We talk about diary writing, what Philip's teenage self would think about what he is doing now, why there is an important role for faith, whether our sense of vocation expands with age, and at the very end of the interview, Philip reveals why he is more of a living in the present type of person. What a huge privilege this week to interview Philip Bubaya from the University of Kent for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. It is an absolute pleasure to have Philip Bubaya this afternoon from the School of History. And we've known each other, Philip, well, probably the whole 15 years that I've been at Kent.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and how long have you been at the University
of Kent?
I've
been at Kent since 1995.
Yeah. So, and you've probably witnessed lots of changes in that time.
Yes, it certainly changed, expanded hugely. The department has changed. There are very few members of the department who were there then who are here now. Yeah, atmosphere has changed. The world has changed.
Yeah. Yeah, I always find that, because particularly in religious studies, and actually certainly after 2001, when suddenly, whereas my subject was often seen to be a little bit airy-fairy or a bit ivory tower-based, suddenly we had lots of parents of school children saying, you know, either it is very important or it isn't very important that you teach Islam, etc.
Right.
So, but suddenly it was the subject that nobody could get away from. So rather than a redundant subject that you sort of didn't have to do in school, or it was sort of, or you had to do it and it was, you know, not necessarily taken seriously, suddenly this was sort of, well, you know, world affairs and politics is inextricably connected with the study of religion. So we suddenly found ourselves really on the map in a way that perhaps was just a dream when I was an undergraduate in the early 90s.
So
similar, and of course we'll be in the same school from very shortly.
That's true. And in 1995, it was because I came here as a Russian specialist. It was just 4 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So it had a, you know, that event was very sort of vivid in the mind and shaped all the study. And but now, nearly 25 years on, that's actually a long way in the past. And and our studies and perspectives on it have changed, and the students' interests have changed. So the subject has kind of gone through an evolution.
Yeah, because I sometimes feel a little guilty when I find that
if I'm teaching a course on religion and film, that I'm aware that a lot of the material is the same as what I taught 15 years ago. Obviously, new books come out, you incorporate that. And sometimes, of course, you want to bring in new films, but you're aware that the edifice or the methodology or some of the key thinkers are the same. So sometimes I think, well, the students don't know this, but, you know, I would have given a very similar lecture 10 years ago. But, of course, there are some modules where you can never do that, and I'm guessing yours is obviously one such one.
No, I think there are bits of the edifice that are pretty much the same. I suppose the perspective on one subject, particularly in history, everything is about perspective. And something that seems very clearly one thing at one moment, 20 years on, looks different because of what's happened in between.
Yeah. And so where were you immediately before you came to Kent?
I was 2 years a lecturer at the London School of Economics.
Yeah.
And just prior to that, or a year or so prior to that, I was... I did my PhD at the London School of Economics from 1989 to 92.
And one of the questions I'll ask later is this whole notion of, you know, would you have expected to end up then, you know, where you are now? But it sounds as though there's an obvious, and the same in my case as well, an obvious sort of trajectory that you do a PhD, you go into university teaching. But it's only sometimes with hindsight you look back and think, how did I spend, in your case, 24 years at the University of Kent?
Quite. I think that what appears to be inevitability in a career with hindsight isn't quite like that.
And of course, often... and we find it in plenty of other subjects, including my own. But, you know, people who do a PhD often because they really want and cherish a full-time job. But often, of course, you're competing for the same posts. You know, you go into the same interviews with the same colleagues who are in the same position as you from all around the country and beyond. And in that sense, it really is a labour of love. And I think that, you know, when I did my own PhD, I expected and assumed and hoped that there would be a career in academia. But at the same time, there was always the very clear sense that there's no inevitability in that.
I agree.
And going way back, in terms of sort of earliest memories, what can you remember from childhood? And you know, I suppose related to that, what did your parents do?
Yes, so I grew up in, born in Oxford in 1963. Grew up in Oxford. What did I enjoy as a child? I became very keen on football, sports. We were a sport-loving family. My parents were kind of what you might call full-time Christian workers with a charity which was called Moral Rearmament. And you could describe my father's work as kind of being an informal chaplain to what was quite an international organization. So we had a lot of people from different parts of the world coming to visit us at home, a lot of visitors. So that was quite stimulating. We grew up in Oxford. My mother's family were from the Welsh border, so we often spent holidays down there. My mother was quite artistic, interested in the arts. She wrote a play in the 1970s, a musical play about St. Columba. So we had the kind of interest in the arts in the family. I liked fishing, or I came to like fishing, fly fishing.
Particularly with the faith angle as well, has that carried forward? Has that been an influence? Because quite a few people I've interviewed have had similar sort of stories of growing up in particular traditions, in particular communities, and then in a way sort of not necessarily even thinking about it, but it's there are always a lot of things that you pick up at childhood and maybe you don't imagine that it's necessarily going to carry forward for sort of many years into the future. But have there been many, sort of, you mentioned fishing and sports as well, have they all sort of carried forward in varying degrees into adulthood?
Yes, they have. Yeah, many of those interests I've retained. I can see sort of similarities between who I was then and now. Yes, it was a faith an environment in which faith was important. And I did have some experiences of my own in my mid-teens, which have shaped the way my life has gone. And so I suppose the faith became real to me. and have shaped the way I've looked at the world. Probably made me quite sort of reflective, and made me interested in what I would call meaning of life questions, philosophical, theological questions. I've always, but that's also probably my character as well, as well as my background. So A-levels were Russian, history and English, which were plenty of opportunity for sort of indulging questions like that. But yes, the other things like sport, fishing, to a less degree perhaps, but it's funny how you can see the same characteristics in yourself 40 years ago as you have now.
Yeah, and I find, I remember my mum once saying that she looked at herself in the mirror not too many years ago, and she thought for a minute that she saw her own mother, who had passed away by that point, looking back at her. She suddenly thought, I never thought I looked like my mother, but I can now see, you know, when she was in her late 60s, early 70s, she could see that resemblance. And of course, then there's also then the characteristics. And I can see it in, you know, I'm completely down the line, you know, 50% my mother, 50% my father.
Yes.
The way I talk, the way I express myself, some of the interests I have. And it's kind of funny, but because when you're young, sometimes even as a teenager, you partly sometimes want to distance yourself from your family. And then later years, you realise you are who you are because, and you can't escape that in the sense of you have a particular sort of disposition sometimes. And I guess that's, you know, to varying degrees, you know, people are comfortable with that or not. But it is funny when you realise that it's almost as though there's a certain, I'm not going to go so far as to say, you know, you're predestined to go down a certain path, but it's easy to find these patterns and structures.
That is absolutely true.
Yeah.
I think perhaps this has come up in other interviews, but I think anybody who has a faith but also comes from a faith background has that challenge of making it your own. And perhaps in any form of life, wherever you're shaped, how do I find my own thing within that? And I think that that's always a permanent, perhaps it's a permanent issue for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, what is my contribution?
Mm.
And at the same time, as you say, as you get older, you realise that much of your own distinctive contribution is kind of inherited from others.
Yeah.
And you can't avoid that. That is the nature of life.
Yeah, because sometimes on a superficial level, you can say, I mean, my parents didn't go to university. But at the same time, some of the interests that I have and the way that I, or maybe it's also the commitment. I've been here for 15 years, but my dad worked on the railway for 48 years
before he retired.
Did he? So, I mean, it changed around him. So he could hardly say he was doing the same job, especially after privatisation in the 90s. But that sort of sense of you go into something and you give it your best shot and you don't give up. And so although we followed in very different career paths, in terms of the way, you know, when I don't see my parents as often as I'd like to, but particularly at Christmas time, for example, you know, when we're having a chat and he would talk about the way he would work with his fellow you know, colleagues on the railways, and the various problems that he would have to deal with. And I thought, that is exactly what I do or have done as senior tutor. So suddenly I could see that the way that my dad was perceived and the sort of often the jobs that he would be given or he would voluntarily take on are almost identical to the way that I work in this profession. And it was just surreal to suddenly think, I've had exactly the same experience.
Yes.
But I didn't know it until you mentioned
identify.
It now.
I can identify with that, absolutely.
Yeah. So in terms of things that you enjoyed doing as a child, obviously you mentioned sport, but what about music, for example? Because I had this huge obsession. I don't have it anymore, other than in a historical context of, you know, reminiscing about the charts, the sort of music and the sounds of the times. Twin interest, my dad's music and my mum's music from the late 50s, early 60s. I grew up with that and still listen to it to this day. Mm-hmm. But also my own sort of growing up mainly in the 80s, sort of all of that. But that was always the big thing in the playground, you know. We'd always sort of compare notes on what we were listening to. But did you have any of the same sort of interest musically?
A little bit. I mean, as you say, it was a big issue in the playground, what you were listening to, what's the latest thing in the charts. I think when I started listening, there were bands like Slade and Mudd, who were very popular, and then people were were copying all sorts of sort of heavy metal bands. Yeah. And I remember sort of trying hard to like some of the stuff that was popular and sort of feeling a bit ambivalent about it. I came eventually to quite like the sort of more folky, reflective stuff of Bob Dylan and Moody Blues, that kind of thing. But I wouldn't say that I was completely into that world. But in terms of the culture of school, it was very big.
Yeah, and my sense as well, and it's no doubt very different in a world now where people stream music and everything is digital. But, you know, people would bring their transistor radios, as they were called, you know, on a Tuesday lunchtime, and rather sneakily or sometimes quite audaciously, you know, but listen to the charts and the countdown. But it was those sort of things that almost sort of like would, you know, would kind of define us in a particular era that my children, who are obviously very young, probably wouldn't, you know, would find. In fact, I don't think they would know what a vinyl was, but they wouldn't because or a cassette tape. But it's funny because these are the things that really seem to matter. And I look back now and think they wouldn't matter to me in the same way now. But those same records, those same charts, in some cases, those same countdowns, sort of matter now because that sense of anticipation and apprehension and the comparing and contrasting in the playground, that has resonated, that has stayed with me all the years since. And I still often define myself in relation to particular musical tastes. And I've never been into the same sort of mainstream music. You know, I've quite kitschy sort of, you know, children's favourites, junior choice type music. But it's interesting that sort of it's often that marker, and we identify ourselves in relation to other people's, you know, whether they're the cool kids or not.
Yes. No, there was an element of the competition to be cool in the whole music world.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, but I think I'm at a stage now in my life when I think I define myself by being on the other side of, you know. Yes. but often, of course, the music that I grew up then and seemed to matter, often, you know, people in many cases never heard of anymore. Yes, so, yes. You know, so in that sense, it doesn't really matter. People are not so judgmental. But how did you end up entering this profession? How did you end up as a university?
So at the school I went to, which was outside Oxford, Abingdon School, there was opportunities for Russian O and A level, and I did that. And then I did modern languages with Russian and Italian. So I was a Russian specialist and had my interest and imagination caught by Russia, literature, politics, and so on. So I did modern languages in the early 80s at Cambridge. And I never thought of academia, although I had a kind of obvious academic, a kind of academic mind. Mm. Did a master's degree in America after that at Georgetown University, Russian area studies. And that's when I started to write research papers. And I did a course in that on Russian religious thought. Mm. And in the course of that, stumbled across a particular thinker who I really liked. Mm. And when I came back from America, circumstances sort of shaped my life so that I went and did a PhD at the London School of Economics writing about this figure. I wrote a life and work of this man, Simeon Frank was his name, which was very exciting, including taking me to Moscow in the first part of 1991 to the Institute of Philosophy, and, you know, going around Moscow archives in the year that the Soviet Union collapsed. Incredibly exciting that was. Yeah. So I kind of got, and I was at the London School of Economics teaching Russian politics and writing about Russian intellectual history, and then eventually the sort of academic door opened out of that. Yeah. But the journey was not really driven by the desire to be in academia. It was more that I found some ideas and some thinkers who I found exciting and felt comfortable studying, and it became somehow the obvious thing as the PhD advanced that was the profession to go for.
Yes.
It hadn't been planned.
Yeah. But had you made many trips to Russia itself? I mean, did that come later? Because was it a case of study? I mean, obviously, I'm guessing there would have been, even as part of the degree, there would have been some kind of trip, would there have been? To the
Well,
former
we,
Soviet
we went
Union,
as a school. There was a school trip in 1980.
Yeah.
And then at Cambridge, we had a year out.
Yeah.
So nearly 5 months in Moscow, four months in Paris doing Russian.
Yeah.
That was the 5 months in Moscow just before Gorbachev came to power.
Yes.
That was also a very vivid experience. But when the PhD started, just on the edge of the PhD, I went with an older friend from Scandinavia as a translator for a person who was well connected with the Soviet dissidents and the sort of human rights movement. And I became very interested in the Russian human rights movement out of that. And that was sort of concurrent with the PhD, and then it shaped my research afterwards.
Yeah. And you mentioned 1980 as well, and of course, I mean, I was only about seven at the time, but I can remember, and the same happened, of course, in 1984 with the Olympics and the boycott.
Absolutely.
And the way in which, and I suppose in later years we had it with South Africa and the cricket tours, but you were going to a place that was, you know, really, you know, persona non grata in the rest of the world. That must have been fascinating, but also a bit bewildering, but also probably a little bit, I don't know, but scary. But
it was a tiny bit scary. I mean, I can even remember 1984, though, you know, we visited with various Russians and felt a bit nervous about it. I can remember that. I can also remember giving a talk in at least one or even two Russian schools about English culture. Yeah. And there was something kind of, you felt, perhaps slightly humorously now, but you felt like a pioneer of sort of, speaking to people who people wouldn't necessarily get access to, and trying to articulate your own background and world to them.
Yeah.
That was very exciting.
Yeah. No, I was much older when I did any sort of, when any overseas travelling, I was well into my 20s before I got my first passport, and I've sort of made up for it since. But I do, but that is the curiosity, isn't it? That, you know, seeing the world through the lens of somebody else. You know, we all have our own. I mean, I was at a wedding the other day, and it was almost quite funny because I was talking to somebody who didn't know where Canterbury was, but then they were talking about going to Menorca or somewhere, and I had absolutely no idea where they were talking about. So it was almost this sense that we all work in our own little bubbles sometimes. Mm. But what you must have had from going to Russia then is just, and also of course you've got what's happening in the news and following the events from a media perspective, but actually being there on the ground, as it were, and I'm guessing having a very different sort of take of, because often the news is often about the political leaders of the time and all the, and obviously in later years we had perestroika and so on, but I'm guessing in your case you were seeing things from a very different point of view, a very idiosyncratic perspective, which obviously then was able to ground your subsequent research.
I mean, there was a big contrast between the being there as an undergraduate in 1984 and then as a postgraduate in 1991. In the latter, the country had changed a lot in those six or seven years. And also, because of the studies, I had kind of access to all sorts of interesting people in the kind of higher education world and in the in some cases in the human rights world. And you had an amazing entry point and sort of perspective on what was going on from people. So the country itself opened up in a very, very evident way. It was very different.
And did you, and have you stayed in contact with many people?
Some of them.
Have you been, I'm guessing social media these days can help, but I'm guessing back then it would have been very hard to maintain correspondence. I guess, you know, letter writing would have been the obvious route to go. But that the things that we take for granted these days, I go to conferences and there'll be somebody from the other side of the world and we're, you know, Facebook friends or whatever it is instantaneously.
Right.
But how did you manage things in the 1980s or indeed in
91? Well, I think it wasn't easy to keep up with people in that period and even just after, but somehow you made a concerted effort to do that. I mean, through the 90s, I kept up with many of these threads through the 90s and then into the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Somehow it's not been as easy to go back regularly in the last decade and a half, partly because life circumstances have changed a bit.
And what about particular teachers, either at school or at university, who inspired you? I mean, there's always that question, isn't there? But, you know, where do... I mean, I often feel when I'm teaching, I'm channeling particular... Maybe it's things that I learned, you know, teachers, you know, professors who taught me when I was at university, or, you know, where does the passion come? But also when it comes to the actual art of communication, you know, as a student, you're often thinking, I like that particular method. I particularly like that person has held my attention. So there are ways in which you're emulating certain sort of styles. Yep. You know, you know, if you're going to stay in a profession long term, you obviously need to make sure that you know what you need to do in order to disseminate yourself, or to become the teacher that you have to be. And did you have any of those sort of experiences or particular role models?
No, I had good teachers and teachers I got on well with throughout the period, but I wouldn't pick out a sort of definitive teacher who sort of shaped one. I was lucky with my PhD supervisor, who was Dominic Levin, who is a now research professor in Cambridge, who's a well-known Russian historian. But his approach is so different from what a PhD supervisor is now. It was sort of, you know, get on with it. And when you've got something, you know, show me. Much less regimented, but gave you the freedom. But he had, you know, good judgment, good insights. I'm grateful to that. At undergraduate level, in many ways, what was stimulating was being part of a sort of bright peer group who are always wrestling with ideas, challenging you, sort of keeping you up to the mark. I do remember that.
Yeah. And I found at school as well, it's a very competitive environment. And I wonder if it was largely, I mean, I went to a brilliant school, it was a Church in Wales school in Cardiff, but I really felt sometimes that there were always going to be pupils who were sharper, cleverer, just sort of had the knack.
Yes.
Perhaps in later years, I suddenly thought, you know, I'm doing okay. I'm not in competition with these people. But from a young age, there were always going to be the really clever ones, the ones who went on to, and I never applied to Oxbridge, but the ones who, you know, it was almost like inevitable that they would go down that sort of path. But that sort of competition, I'm guessing in some ways was a good thing, because it's almost as though you then think, right, I want to do well, but you kind of want to both keep up, not just because of them, but also in terms of their own sense of, you know, what is it that you aspire to be here for? I mean, you know, when I was younger, I used to feel sometimes at school, when I was very young, it almost felt as though we went to school to conform, to be disciplined, to sort of be, right. You know, it was the right behaviour, the right thing to do. We'd start in a church school, you'd say the prayers at the beginning and the end of the day, and there'd be, you know, during that, you know, you'd have to walk on the right side in the corridor, or actually the left side, but, you know, in the right side, and the teacher would go on one side, you'd go on the other, and, you know, you'd have to make sure you played for 10 minutes and you came straight back in. And in a way, it was only later on I thought the content is, you know, and of course, certainly A-level and university, I thrived. But it was almost as though I really, at a much later age, really enjoyed education for its own sake, rather than just that sense of doing the right thing and making sure that you didn't say or do the wrong thing that the teacher would shout at you.
I think that's a very interesting thing, and that one's motivations for what one does change over time, and they perhaps sometimes deepen.
Yeah.
But I think you're hinting at another issue, which I think has been an important issue for me in life, but also in academia, and that's confidence. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible, of course, that many academics secretly are quite insecure, and they use their... I've sometimes wondered whether we sometimes use our desire for expertise as a way of covering up our lack of confidence. I worked hard and did quite well academically, but I think it's taken me quite a long time to develop confidence that I've actually, you know, perhaps like many academics, when you get a job to begin with, you're not sure that you're really up to it. And then it takes you time to sort of realize that you are up to it. But also to find your own voice, the things that you really want to say and contribute. I think confidence is a big issue for everybody in life, but I think it's a hidden big issue for academics.
I couldn't agree more, because one thing that I found and have found in several of the interviews, and the term has come up sufficiently for it to be a pattern, is imposter syndrome. People who say, you know, I'm not sure I'm supposed to be here. They're going to find me out. But then often you can be there for a few years and people come and go and you think, well, hang on, I'm still here. And I seem to be making a contribution, and people seem to appreciate what I'm doing. and therefore you perhaps some of those inhibitions go. But confidence is a huge thing, because I mean, I remember giving my very first lecture. I was still doing, I don't even think I was doing my PhD then. I think I was coming to the end of my master's, or maybe just started the PhD, and I was asked to cover for a colleague at short notice, and I prepared this lecture. And looking back, it was disastrous, because it was a combination of reading it out, but reading out too quickly, and then suddenly realizing that, the lecture was, say, an hour, and sort of I was about 10, 15 minutes in, and I suddenly thought, oh, at the pace I'm going, I'm going to run out of material. And just things like that. And of course, these days, you know, there are ways of ensuring that sort of thing doesn't happen. But you know, in a way, it is learning on the job. It has to be.
It does, yeah. That's right. And certainly in my own discipline, in history, you ought to get better at your job, because your perspective broadens all the time. And it is a subject where perspective matters.
And do you find that as well in terms of, I mean, certainly as an undergraduate, I don't recall ever having, well, maybe we had a few seminars, but it was very much material was disseminated, and the key thing was writing it all down, and it was sort of making sure that we'd got the basics. Then we'd go and get and look at the books and sort of supplement all of that. Whereas these days often, and I actually enjoy it, those sort of that lecture or seminar that's right on the cusp of the other, that you're disseminating information, but the students are asking, and you've said something that has inspired them, and suddenly something has connected, and you feel that it's okay just to almost step back, because the questions are directly related to what you're saying, and then you kind of feel that's better than a scenario whereby you just have no idea whether everybody is understanding you, whether they want to understand you, whether they're bored, or, you know, are they there out of passion for the subject or because they're doing it for credit. But sometimes you sort of just get a feel for the audience, as it were, and that's the time when you suddenly think, I've done it, something has clicked, and, you know, it's almost like I found the secret ingredient, and I want to make sure that I get that back at subsequent lecture opportunities.
I do agree with that, and I find that there are many ways of trying to relate what you're doing historically to the lives and opportunities that the students are facing in front of you. Mm-hmm. So, for example, my Russian history course begins in 1881 with the assassination of Alexander II. Multi-ethnic state, how do you hold it together? Britain now, how do you hold a kind of multi-ethnic, in a certain sense, state together? Or Gorbachev, leadership. What does it mean to give leadership when you're trapped in a difficult situation? Everybody's going to face that in their lives. They're going to face being caught in a difficult situation. How do you find your way through it? So I think it's exciting to have the confidence to take your subject and relate it to the life situation of the students.
And you must see all those patterns, and inevitably, obviously, with world events, also closer to home with elections here, I'm guessing sometimes I find it almost quite funny, because obviously we're dealing with lots, you know, Brexit is coming up all the time. But the first election in which I voted was in 1992. Yep. And of course it was, well, it's almost as though the bubble then burst just a few months later with the Maastricht treaty and getting that ratified. And it is a case of history repeating itself. And I think of Ken Clark, who was saying that whereas, he was the sort of towards the left of the party, and he was pro-Europe, and you had all the rebels who were on the right, and they were the ones who, the whip was taken away from them under John Major. But now Ken Clark said a few years ago he's now the rebel, and he said, "How has that happened?" But I'm just old enough to remember his earlier incarnations as under both Margaret Thatcher and John Major. But I find those patterns fascinating, and I'm guessing that you must absolutely. Must and with your students you must be so keen to impart a lot of those analogies and parallels.
I think so, and I think that. I think that you are that because there is a sense that if you ask these questions well and in a stimulating way, they will equip people for the kind of lives that they've got ahead of them. That's satisfying, and as you say, you sometimes feel you've suddenly connected. You have suddenly that change in the atmosphere in a seminar, and you realise that everybody's sort of suddenly interested. They've caught that this is relevant.
And I certainly found, a decade ago, students didn't. Well, I can't say whether they voted or not in an election, but I certainly found that I'd sometimes say things like, "Did anyone see Newsnight last night?" No one did. But suddenly something then has clicked into place, and it's been a very different, quite a sea change for all sorts of reasons. But I think also that people are very active in a way that wasn't the case, certainly when either when I was an undergraduate or certainly when I started teaching. And I used to find sometimes that I'd be drawing on world events in order to explain certain things that I was doing in the lecture. And sometimes it resonated, a lot of the time that it didn't.
Yeah.
And I find now the opposite is the case, and the students themselves are often coming up with particular examples, and I'm always catching up with them.
Understood.
So, have you found similar sort of patterns?
I have, actually, yes. I feel that the many students now, they have kind of a slightly eclectic knowledge, so I can refer to big events that have happened over the weekend.
Yeah.
And it's clear that people have really hardly aware of them.
Mm.
So I think some students are politically or socially or morally engaged in some way, and they're more attuned, and others perhaps are sort of bow out of being really engaged.
Yeah. And can you remember the first time you voted in an election? Can you remember what that felt like in terms of that whole sort of notion of making a difference? For me, it was the most exciting thing ever, of going to that ballot box and casting my vote.
I can't, actually. I mean, I think it was 1983 when Mrs. Thatcher won the election after the Falkland, you know, a year after the Falklands War.
With a landslide, of course.
Yeah, and I don't think there was quite as much tension in that election. Because the opinion polls pointed very clearly into what was... I can remember the 1979 election when I was at school, and that was a major issue. And with hindsight, a major change in British political history when she won it. But of course, there were exciting events, elections. Yeah. There's no doubt. They still are.
I remember when David Cameron was saying that he would. I think he was born in 66. So, but he said he barely remembers the 79 election. He would have been 13 or thereabouts. And I remember thinking, you know, it's almost bizarre because, you know, I was, and obviously I haven't gone into politics, and yet these shaped us in the way. I mean, I was obsessive. In the 92 election, I'd be the person, because I did have my own black and white TV, but, you know, I'd be dashing back to my room or going into the student union or wherever there was a TV in order to catch, you know, the latest updates on the news, because we had teletext in those days, but I didn't have access to it on my small black and white TV. So, yes, I'd have the radio on, listen to the hourly broadcast, but we didn't have social media, we didn't have BBC News website, so I was just lapping this up, and the excitement about, you know, because in 92 I was only five going on six when Margaret Thatcher won, so I didn't remember a Labour government, but it looked at one point as though Labour were going to win in 92.
I remember that very vividly.
And there were some opinion polls generally showed that maybe the Conservatives had a slim lead, but there were enough polls to suggest that at the very least a hung parliament was likely. And this was like the most important thing, one of the most important things up to that point. And it did feel a little bit anticlimactic then when we had the result, because we kind of had the same government, but with a wafer-thin majority that they ended up sustaining for the 5 years of that parliament. But it's these sort of like shaping experiences,
big events,
and the way that we all invest our hopes in particular parties, and then what happens when those candidates sort of let us down. But you must have seen that on a very different scale with Russia, and with Gorbachev, for example, who turned out to be sort of, you know, a sort of almost a very forward looking thinker who a lot of people in the West admired, which couldn't have been said for his immediate predecessors.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Gorbachev, people were very ambivalent about what his agenda was when he came to power, and some had great hopes that he would be a reformer, and others were very sceptical. And even now we debate about, you know, who was Gorbachev in class, and people, you know, students really can't make him out.
Yeah.
I do remember when I was in America doing my master's in 1988, and there was an enthusiastic student who said, look, the Soviet Union is in trouble, and it could really get into difficulties. And it seems so entrenched that I thought the guy was off his rocker.
Mm.
You know, it was so. I did a Soviet foreign policy class, and the guy this is autumn of 86. The guy started off and he said, "The following are countries who've gone communist and haven't, and where the Communist Party have never fallen."
Yeah.
In other words, the narrative was, you know, communism is so strong that the chances of it, of these states falling is practically nil.
Mm.
And, you know, 5 years later it had collapsed.
Yeah.
And the dynamic of events was totally incredible.
Yes, and that was all around the time I did my A-level. So the summer of 91 with the August coup. That was, you know...
That was a mega event.
But that was something, you know, really on a scale that nobody could have anticipated. Yeah. But I do remember studying the Cuban Missile Crisis when I was in my GCSE year. So that would have been late 1980s. And then we're talking about, that was so 27-ish, 26, 27 years before. And yet, of course, what was remarkable is that the same leader, Fidel Castro, was still in power. Yeah. And so that almost sort of didn't quite fit that paradigm that you refer to. And of course, it was only a few years ago Castro and then his brother was, you know, in power. So it's almost as though you say that sometimes there's this particular narrative. And I know Ed Miliband had the same issue with his father and, you know, the whole issue about, you know, his particular, you know, being a Marxist historian. But sort of sometimes there's the official narrative, the counter narrative. I remember even in my PhD Viva, I'd drawn on Marx in the context of the relationship between religion and materialism, and my PhD was nothing to do with that, but it was a good analogy to draw on. I remember my internal examiner actually then using it as an opportunity to say, he didn't so much query my use of Marx, but felt almost politically. He said, but of course, the course of the 20th century has proven that Marxism was wrong. And I was thinking, that, you know, how interesting. It's like, that's got nothing to do with the thesis, but why did you feel the need to say that? Because I was looking at, you know, the Marx and religion, you know, almost in a sort of cerebral context, right, rather than necessarily looking at it in terms of applying that to, and whether Marxism in the 19th century and communism in the 20th century were necessarily congruous anyway. But it's interesting that almost that needs to come out in, you know, in a very peculiar context. But luckily the external examiner was sort of like twitching a little bit, thinking, we're not going to go down that path, which is probably a good thing, but it did make me smirk that I thought, you know, almost as though the examiner felt he had to sort of show his ideological leanings, you know, even with me in a Viva, you know, really it wasn't going to change the world.
Well, that's right.
But
and I suppose in, you know, when you look at Russia in 91 or 1917, you and perhaps even we don't know where Britain's going right now, but you it's interesting how events happen very fast and unpredictably in some situations. That's in itself there's something kind of instructive about it.
But that must make you so passionate about your subject, because in a way, living history, what you're studying, as you say, that often you might be dealing with events from the 1880s, but the perspective on them, of course, is going to change in the terms of subsequent events and contemporary debates. But in a way, you've got the kernel, the scaffolding is already there, but the perspectives, you know, you that sense that you can never, you know, you can never feel that you're just sort of like giving out the same information. You know, there's always a sense in which this is always going to galvanize for different reasons due to contemporary parallels and analogies, Putin, etc., that, you know, your students sometimes must make you think, as happens in my case, you think, oh, I hadn't seen it from that perspective, or what an interesting way of looking at something that I'd sort of, you know, got sucked and, you know, stuck into my own sort of mindset on.
I think the subject which I've kind of thought is relevant both to today's Britain and to Russia, but also, as I was saying a bit before, one's own life experience is how it's easy to have sort of abstract ideas about how people ought to behave, but most people and all of us are kind of embedded in a situation which is not perfect.
Yeah.
And it's slightly flawed. And how do you behave in that?
Yeah.
How do you balance the sort of pressures of your circumstances with what you feel ought to be done?
Yeah.
That's basically an ordinary human experience. And Russia in a way dramatizes that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in that sense, you were talking about earlier about, you know, why do you do the subject you're doing, and I suppose there is a sense that at least the way in which you teach your subject as you develop in confidence starts to be shaped by the underlying questions that you yourself are asking about life.
Yeah.
You can't avoid that.
Yeah.
And perhaps it should.
Yeah.
Perhaps it should.
And you can mould that, although I often find that there's a difference between talking to your students for hours on end about these things in the classroom and then going to the supermarket or somewhere where sometimes you feel that somebody asks you what you do, what you study, and you then feel sometimes this sense of disconnection. I sometimes have that, particularly in the study of religion.
Oh, yeah.
And you're aware, you're thinking, I have to think about how I answer this, because, you know, what I might say with my students for 2 hours in the afternoon may not actually be as appropriate a conversation here, because sometimes, you know, people will often sort of say, oh, well, you know, you're studying religion. Religion is, you know, means this to me, means that to me. With the students, we very rarely, if ever, does anyone really feel the need to, I mean, voluntarily they might say, I have a faith, I don't have a faith, but it's in a way it's the elephant in the room. We might look at what Marx says about religion, mm-hmm. but nobody then has to sort of say whether they might agree with the ideas, but nobody then has to sort of come out and say this is you know my religious conviction. That really isn't something we talk about. But often in another context, and that's something you do have to give over. And I've often been wrong-footed when somebody might ask me in the supermarket sometimes, you know, what is your faith, in a way that never comes up, you know, when you're
researching talking about
this.
It.
No, in that context, and it's almost like, how interesting, it's the obvious question to ask, but it's the one that we never ask.
That's right. Well, I sometimes think that maybe I'm becoming a bit academic here, the big question, which in a way, is the elephant in the room all the time is, how do you live a good life? And what does it mean to be good? Mm. But how practically do you do that? But actually, you can't study that at university.
Yeah.
You can only study it by implication, but you can't. Very rarely do you actually discuss it.
Yeah. No, and I find it because one of the courses I teach is called Death and the Afterlife, and I always think for that reason that in a way we're dealing with the ultimate meaning of life questions, and yet obviously there are some students who are so passionate about this and they really want to explore this, and you know, often personal faith or whatever convictions motivate them, and then other times you're aware that of course the students are doing it for credit at the end of the day. They're writing the essays, they're doing that because they want to get their degree.
Yeah.
But you feel, and that's perfectly fine, but you do sometimes feel that they're not going to get as excited as perhaps I sometimes feel that I'm getting in having these conversations, because really, the reason they're there, they might have those conversations, I guess, outside of the classroom, but in their own terms, whereas here, they're listening to me because I guess it's the sense of, well, we're doing this for study. So really, they're not necessarily looking to apply the actual content of what
That's
I'm
right.
doing outside that. And I always find that a curiosity, and also probably what made me want to do these sort of interviews, because there's always that question of, you know, what made you do what you're doing? Where does that passion come from? And how does it apply? What of all the things you could have done in your life, how did you end up here? And how did you end up here now?
That's right.
Yeah, and it'll take me a lifetime to unpack that, because there are multiplicity of different answers. But as we start to wrap up, Philip, what about some more philosophically based questions?
Right.
Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
I would say they are, but I wouldn't say it's sort of unremittingly positive. Mm. I mean, I think there have been kind of, I suppose as a young person, I look back, I feel I was quite insecure in some ways. Didn't always find it easy to connect with people. So I look back and I think I don't look back on everything that's happened with total sort of in a totally positive way. Mm. I think I'm pretty peaceful about this. So I'd make a slight distinction between being peaceful and being positive.
Mm.
But there have been many happy episodes. Also, I don't know whether this is your experience, but I sometimes retell my own stories. So at one point in your life, you know, a particular episode looks like that. And then you round a corner and then you think, actually, it looks like that. Mm. So we're always revising our stories.
Yeah. And I find as well, because obviously I do a lot of these interviews and I'm aware that I'm, like in the example I gave about teaching earlier, when you're aware that you're perhaps recycling stuff that you did 5-10 years ago. But of course, it's, you know, in terms of consistency of narrative, that sometimes you are giving the same examples, but you're perhaps applying them in different contexts. But you're right, that sort of life situations in different periods, like a good example, because my next question actually is going to be about whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. And the reason I ask that is because in my own case, I can think back to the early 1990s as a student, and suddenly, you know, I went from not having written an essay, apart from obviously at school we had to do these all the time, but sort of writing an essay in a university environment with proper footnoting, and rather than the teachers giving us the sources, giving us the material, actually having to, you know, do our own research, and feeling, oh, I can do this. and thriving at that, and suddenly thinking, where did that come from? You know, 2 weeks ago I knew nothing about this topic, and now I've written an essay on the disestablishment of the church in Wales, whatever it might be, thinking, ooh, you know, I have a view on this, and I can engage with these experts. So I found that something happened there, and it fell into place. And when I look back, it's not necessarily that I'm saying then that I want it to be 1993 or whatever again, but the skills that I learned there, I often find that I can apply in other situations. That you think, if I thought about it at the time, I'd think, I know nothing about this topic. You'd see the reading list or the list of questions at the beginning of the course, and you think, I can't answer this. I know nothing. But then a few weeks later, you'd say, well, I've done the research. Now I know the answer. So it's applying that to another situation. So something that feels you're apprehensive about something, it's a skill that you acquire. And then, of course, the danger is you look back on that period and think, oh, it was a doddle because the outcome was satisfactory. And you almost imagine then that it was the outcome was preordained because of hindsight. Does that sort of apply in your case?
Well, I think you're throwing up some sort of quite big questions here about... you're talking about whether you can be... nostalgic about negative experiences. I think we have an innate tendency to try to make a meaning out of negative experiences and turn them into lessons that we can learn from. And perhaps that's something which is essentially healthy, that we want to do that because we want to give our story a meaning.
Yeah.
I think there are episodes that I prefer, I don't feel great nostalgia about, don't feel particularly proud about. Don't sort of rush to remember, if in all honesty. So I think when you use the word negative, I think there are different types of negativity. Mm. I think there are difficult experiences. Mm. Perhaps there are experiences where we've mucked up, which might be the same, but might be different.
Yeah.
But coming back to what you say, some of the difficult experiences or bad experiences are the ones that have made us who we are. We've shaped us. We've really learned from, and without which we couldn't have gone on to do something else, which was positive. But nostalgia is about how you remember. It's how you remember, and I suppose I think this is quite a complicated area.
Yeah, because indeed some people, indeed in this series, have referred to nostalgia as being forward-looking, or to say it's not really about the past.
Okay.
Because, of course, that's the issue, isn't it? That it's about the perspective on the past.
Right.
And often, as told through the light of those often manifold, but, contemporary experiences. So that, as you say, you might give a variation of an answer, depending on the context and the time in which you say it.
I think also the way you remember can depend on your mood. So to use a sort of example, if you feel really steamed up and angry about something, in a way that kind of gets you sort of in a deeper way, you can then interpret your whole life from the point of view of that anger. And you remember things that are in the spirit of that. Whereas if you're feeling more peaceful and you've rounded a corner and maybe you've had an argument with somebody and it's been and you've reconciled with them, then suddenly you remember things differently. Did you not?
Yeah.
So your memory is sometimes controlled by your decisions and your state of mind.
Oh yeah, because sometimes it might be that you have seen or haven't seen somebody for a while, or you think, they're ignoring me, or what? All sort of things, and that frames your perspective. And then suddenly, you have this most amazing time with them, and they say, they're the best, best friend I've ever had. And you just think, but last week you were thinking that you must have done something to injure them or something.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of life, but it's just interesting. But the way that we pick out particular episodes, and then almost like take them, and the danger, I guess, is sometimes we objectify them. The danger we often sort of the danger is that we sort of, and people do it with people from I remember being at university sometimes or talking to somebody's parent who would then, there was a problem with somebody, was a family friend who was from a particular country. And then sort of like everybody from that country was almost like tarred with the same brush. You're thinking, that is absurd, but that happens, and people do have that tendency to sometimes generalize in a way that, forgets the fact that we're all quite, even as individuals, quite miscellaneous, heterogeneous people.
We are, that's right. And sometimes maybe just to develop that very point, sometimes there's a struggle going on within us about how to remember an event, you know, and we, you know, yeah. we're wrestling with our memory.
Yeah. Have you ever kept a diary or anything like that? Because I always have done, and therefore I can go back and then see what I thought at the time, or sometimes, of course, I might not think that something at the time was as important as I think it, you know, now was, and sometimes think, why didn't I write so much more on that?
Yeah, that's right, and I have kept diaries, but they've been at different times, but they've been more in the way of a few lines rather than deep sort of. More experiential reflections.
And would you say, I mean, I hinted at this question earlier, but that whole sort of notion about whether you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, what would your younger self, what would your 15-year-old self think about what you're doing now? Would he be surprised that you ended up doing what you're doing now? And sort of, you know, are there still dreams yet to be
achieved? Yeah, that's such a fascinating... I was actually thinking about this recently, that you know, if somebody comes to you as a student and says, you know, should I write about this or about that, we sometimes throw out the phrase like, sort of, well, what does your heart really say about what you should be doing here? Yeah. But that throws back the question about which of the many impulses that which your heart is prompted to aspire after is the right one.
Yeah.
And I think I actually think that's also part of our life journey is to sort of, learn to interpret these sort of different levels of desire that go on within us, and I don't think I would have dreamt of being an academic, but I think that with hindsight, my older self might have thought, well, actually, that does fit you. That being said, I find in a narrow sense, I find the academic approach can be limited, and doesn't always provide answers to the deeper questions. I think people sometimes come into academia with the belief that it will, and it doesn't, and so that's where I find I go back to the resources from faith traditions, really, to find answers to those questions.
But that's the great thing in terms of interdisciplinarity, that not just between subject disciplines, but also in life, the way that the one can impact on the other, the personal life experiences, the faith journeys, the academic journeys, and the way that they all can coalesce. Yeah. And if you're the common point between them all, you're the common denominator, then sometimes, you know, you're able to have this huge vantage point sometimes at which, you know, all these different things can potentially coalesce.
But I think there are so many kind of layers of this question about dreams. You know, what were the maybe one layer of that question is, you know, what did I really want, as opposed to what was forced upon me? Do human beings have vocations and callings? And are those callings connected with what you do or who you are, the kind of person that you're most yourself when you're a certain type of person? So that's an interesting question. Another one would be, sorry, I'm turning this into questions but another one would be, does your sense of vocation or your dreams, do they evolve or deepen or expand? I would hope in one way that they expand.
Yeah.
The life is an expanding experience. But then that necessarily means that you might want to break out of a narrow sort of purely career-minded concept of that.
Yeah, because also when you're that age, you may not be aware of all the opportunities that you end up benefiting from. And of course, also a good example is social media. I mean, I met it with a friend who did theology with me at university. Right. Graduated 25 years ago, and she's aware of some of the posts and the videos I put out on social media and so on. And it's interesting. Her take on it was that, of course, 25 years ago we weren't able to do that sort of thing because the technology wasn't there. But she was and hadn't seen me in 25 years, but said it's interesting that it's sort of the stuff I'm doing now is exactly what in a way, she's not surprised that I'm doing any things that I'm doing now. So I, okay. 25 years ago, we couldn't have anticipated where we'd be going, but it's the way that we harness those opportunities in a way that is in keeping with our characters. And I think that that's the crucial bit. It's that authenticity of character, I suppose, or consistency of narrative, that we don't, we can't predict where we'll be. We might not end up doing the job in 20 years' time that we think at the age of 15 or whatever that we're going to do, but what we do is in keeping with the journey that we,
I think,
that is honest to ourselves.
Yeah. Are you saying that, I mean, because one thing which might be the case is that, you know, at a certain point in life we're asking a variety of questions, but as you go on, you begin to realise that one or two of those are the ones that really mean something to you, and that everything sort of seems to revolve around those questions.
Yeah, and it often is the case, isn't it, that sometimes the things that you want to do when you're young, I mean, I had this great dream of being on the radio, and it seemed a little bit of a fanciful hope, really, but in a funny way, it never went away from me, and I love this profession, but there's always been a part of me that's wanted to do something radio related.
Is that right?
And it's never escaped it. And I suddenly feel now that it's almost an inevitability that doing the, I mean, podcast didn't exist 20 years ago, but suddenly now
you found your way to a
found the way. And I could, and it's almost as though I didn't sort of plan this. I didn't sort of get out my book and think, right, in 3 years' time, I'll be running a podcast, but it just sort of fell into place. But it almost feels as though it was going to happen anyway.
I do see that, yeah.
I've got one more question.
Yeah.
Would you, Philip, consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
I would like to be, but I'm not sure that this is quite the, you know, that that's not necessarily the spirit of the interview, but I'd like to be a living in the present type of person. I'm not sure I'm either one or the other quite. I possibly am more looking back in the sense that I'm often sort of trying to make sense of my life journey. But I think my sort of the way my mind has worked over the last few years has increasingly sort of drawn me to how to be more vividly present to the situation I'm in. To people, to God, if you like, but to be satisfied with the present, and not to try to manipulate life, to allow life to grow out of the present.
Yeah. It has been such a cerebral, but also very personal sort of journey as well. So I think we've covered a lot of ground. But Philip, it's been wonderful to catch up with you this afternoon.
Okay, thank you very much.